Hello, warm good afternoon to everyone. It's wonderful to be here and have a large crowd of God's people together. It's always kind of like a mini Feast of Tabernacles to have combined services. Welcome to those on the internet and visiting on by telephone. You might notice if you're here in the hall that we've made some improvements as the school here progresses and adds from time to time. We do have some nice blinds on the back windows. They're also in the process of completely redoing the sound system. And of course, we have a little sound booth built back here that we helped with, and also with the cables under the floor. And with the next fundraiser they have, they're going to put up two big double screens that are either actually going to be motorized. We're helping finance the cost of the motors, and also the double projectors that'll be up on this truss work, so we'll be able to plug into the internet or play CDs or DVDs just by punching a button. And of course, we'll have high-speed internet access already into the booth. So we really appreciate being able to use this facility, and it just seems like God has really blessed us, and we really do appreciate it very much. On April the 5th, 1968, I was 13 years old. I lived on Davis Street in a small wooden framed house, very typical of the older towns in Midwestern United States. We lived on Davis, which was right off of Vermilion Street and about 200 yards from Jackson Street. Jackson Street was the acknowledged border between the white section of town and the black section of town. The night before, a man named Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Riots broke out across the country, and in the little town of Danville where I lived, the 30 or 35% of the population that was black began to riot. I remember going out on my front porch with my stepfather and seeing fire, buildings burning, just about 500 yards away. We could hear gunshots. We could hear sirens. My stepfather said, "They're coming this direction. I'm not going to let them hurt our place." And so he proceeded to load all the guns we had in the house. We had two or three rifles, three or four shotguns. We opened the windows on the downstairs floor. My mother and my little sister left in the car, and essentially it was up to my brother and I, who were 11 and 12, actually I was 13, he was 14, and my stepfather to try to defend our house when the rioters came that direction. Fortunately, they didn't. They didn't cross the line of Jackson Street. The police were able to stop them. But it was one of those events of my childhood that brings me back to a year like we've never had before, a year like we may not have again for a while. It was the year 1968. Books have been written about the year 1968. It's called The Year That Shocked the World. I've got a book here. In fact, that's the title of it, 1968, The Year That Shocked the World. If you'd like to understand the times in which we live now, I strongly recommend you read it. I'll read some of the prologue. This book is by a man named Mark Kurlansky. "There's never been a year like 1968. It is likely there will ever be one again. At a time when nations and cultures were self-separate and very different. In 1968, Poland, France, the United States, and Mexico were far more different from one another than they are today. There occurred a spontaneous combustion of rebellious spirits around the world. For those of us who lived that year, every month virtually was September 11th. There were riots in France. There were riots in Poland. There was the invasion of Czechoslovakia. There were the Olympics in Mexico City. There were the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., of Robert Kennedy, and some others. It seemed like every month the world was going crazier, and the Vietnam War was spiraling out of control with the Tet Offensive and the major battles and the enormous American casualty losses of that year. There have been other years of revolution. 1848 was such a year, but in contrast, 1968 was similar, but much larger. It was not planned. It was not organized. Rebellions were directly through hastily called meetings. Some of the most important decisions were made at a moment's whim. The movements were anti-authoritarian and were so leaderless or had no leaders who denied they were leaders. Ideologies were seldom clear, but there was widespread agreement on very few issues. In 1969, when a federal grand jury indicted 8 activists in connection with the demonstrations in Chicago, Abby Hoffman, one of the 8, said about the group, "We couldn't agree on lunch." But rebellion was everywhere. Rarely did these forces come together, and when they did, with the civil rights, anti-war, and feminist movements in the United States, or the labor and student movements in France and Italy, it was an alliance of temporary convenience. Four historic factors merged to create 1968. The example of the civil rights movement, which at the time was so new and original, a generalization that felt so different and so alienated that it rejected all forms of authority. A war that was hated universally around the world provided a cause for all rebels seeking one. But the American war in Vietnam was not unique and certainly no more reprehensible than numerous other wars, including the earlier French war in Vietnam. But this time it was being pursued by a nation with unprecedented power, and for the first time we had live footage on television of events around the world, primarily the war in Vietnam. Those born in the aftermath of World War II, when Holocaust was a new word and the atom bomb had just been exploded, were born into a world that had very little in common with everything before. The generation that grew up after World War II was so completely different from World War II, that generation, that the ones before it struggled for common ground. They didn't even laugh at the same jokes. Comedians popular with the World War II generation, such as Bob Hope and Jack Benny, were not even remotely funny to the new generation. 1968 was a time of shocking modernism, and modernism always fascinates the young and perplexes the old. Yet in retrospect, it was a time of almost quaint innocence. Imagine Columbia students in New York and University of Paris students discovering from a distance that their experiences were similar and then meeting, gingerly approaching one another to find out what, if anything, they had in common. With amazement and excitement, people learned they were using the same tactics in Prague, in Paris, in Rome, in Mexico, and in New York. With new tools such as communication satellites and erasable videotape, television was making everyone very aware of what everyone else was doing. It was thrilling because, for the first time in human experience, the important distant events of the day were immediate. The book goes on month by month, showing the revolutions in various parts of the world and the tremendous political events that occurred and resulted in social upheaval during that year. I'm going to read now just some highlights of a timeline of the year 1968. Those of you who are old enough can recall that year and will know these events very well because they are burned into our memory. January 5th, Dr. Benjamin Spock, William Sloan Coffin, and novelist Michael Goodman and Michael Ferber, graduate students at Harvard, were arrested as encouraging people to resist the draft. The four were later convicted on June 14th. January the 10th, 1968, the 10,000th U.S. airplane was lost over Vietnam. People worry now because we've lost a dozen or maybe nearly 100 airplanes in Iraq. By January 5th, 1968, we had lost 10,000 airplanes in Vietnam. Not only that, the war was to go on for four more years. January 23rd, North Korean patrol boats captured the USS Pueblo, the first time that an American ship had ever been seized on the high seas. We did nothing about it. I recall my stepdad being so upset that America did not nuke North Korea for taking our ship. They kept the ship, and 11 months later, after very humiliating negotiations, the crew was released on December 22nd. January 31st, at midnight on Wednesday morning, the North Vietnamese launched the Tet Offensive. 70,000 North Vietnamese troops attacked not the jungles this time, but every city in South Vietnam. The offensive carried on for weeks and is noted as the turning point in the war because militarily they lost, but the North Vietnamese won in the minds of the Americans because of television and the other reporting. February 1st, during the police actions of the Tet Offensive, General Nguyen Vac Luan, a South Vietnamese security official, is captured on film executing a Viet Cong prisoner by American photographer Eddie Adams. The picture wins a Pulitzer Prize and becomes the rallying point for the anti-war demonstrators around the world. February 4th, Martin Luther King makes a speech containing his own eulogy, predicting that he will die fairly soon. February 18th, U.S. State Department announces the casualty toll of the Vietnam War has 543 Americans dead in one week. In fact, the year we averaged 39 dead Americans every single day in Vietnam. What do we lose in Iraq now? 5 or 7, maybe 10 a week? We lost 39 every day in that year, not to mention about 10 times that number wounded. After the Tet Offensive, military operations became critical. Walter Cronkite, on February the 27th, in the closing comments of a CBS Evening News, said, after losing or lifting the Tet and several other current military operations as draws and chastising American leaders for their optimism, Cronkite advises negotiation and pullout, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. After watching the program, President Lyndon Johnson said, if we have lost Cronkite, we have lost Middle America. March 12th, New Hampshire primary election brings shocking results. Eugene McCarthy comes within 230 votes of defeating sitting President Lyndon Johnson in the primary. March 16th, Senator Robert Kennedy, former Attorney General, announces he's running for president. March 16th, the same day, U.S. ground troops in Charlie Company rampaged the hamlet of My Lai, killing 500 Vietnamese civilians from infants to the elderly. The massacre continues for 3 hours until American flyers intervene, positioning their helicopters between the troops and the fleeing Vietnamese to protect them. That event goes down as the worst of the Vietnam War events. March 22nd, a few days later, in Czechoslovakia, Anton Novinty resigns as the Czech president, setting off alarm bells throughout the communist world. The Warsaw Pact countries meet in Dresden, East Germany, to discuss how to handle the impending crisis in Czechoslovakia, which was, of course, a movement towards freedom. March 31st, President Johnson delivers his State of the Nation and announces he is not going to seek re-election. 5 days later, April 4th, Martin Luther King spends the day in the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, working a meeting with local leaders on plans for his Poor People's March on Washington. Friends drive up at 6 p.m. He goes outside his room to greet them in the courtyard. He is shot dead by one round from a .30-06 rifle. James Earl Ray is arrested on June 27th in England and convicted later of the prison. King's assassination sparks rioting in Baltimore, Chicago, Boston, Detroit, Kansas City, Newark, Washington, D.C., and many other American cities across the country. April 23rd, a rally and occupation of buildings at Columbia University. Student activists take over 5 buildings at Columbia and hold them for 7 days. The country waits, wondering why the police don't storm in and take control of the buildings from the activists. May 6th, in France, Bloody Monday marks the most violent day of the Russian student revolt, or the Parisian student revolt. 5,000 students marched through the Latin Quarter. Results of the ensuing riot conflict, the police charged and provoked, or demonstrators harassed them. Whatever, the fighting is intense, the rioters set up barricades, and the police attack them with gas grenades. Overnight, the battle will subside, but only after engaging the sympathies of large numbers of French unionists. May 13, the actions taken by students and instructors at Sorbonne inspire sympathetic strikes throughout France. 9 million workers go on strike May 22nd. June 4th, the night of the California primary, Robert Kennedy addresses a large crowd of supporters at the Ambassador Hotel in San Francisco. He has won victories in California and South Dakota and is confident he can now win the Democratic nomination for president. At 12:13 a.m., he leaves the stage. He's shot by Sirhan Sirhan, a 24-year-old Jordanian living in Los Angeles. The 42-year-old Kennedy dies the next day, June the 6th. June 27th, the Prague Spring continues in Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovak writer Ludwig Vidlicek releases his manifesto with 2,000 words, criticizing communist rule and concluding that they have to overthrow the outside threat. Before long, of course, the Soviet Union is very upset and plans an invasion. July 7th, Abby Hoffman's Yippies Are Going to Chicago is published in The Realist. The Yippie movement begins, formed by Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and Paul Krasmer, all committed activists and demonstrators. It's characterized by public displays of disorder, ranging from disrupting the trading floor at the New York Stock Exchange to the destruction of clocks at Grand Central Station. In August 20th, the Soviet Union invades Czechoslovakia with 200,000 Warsaw Pact troops, putting an end to the Prague Spring and bringing about a period of enforced and oppressive normalization. August 26th, Mayor Richard Daley opens the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. While the convention moves haltingly towards nominating Hubert Humphrey, the city's police attempt to enforce 11 o'clock curfew. Demonstrations are widespread across Chicago. The next day, August 28th, by most accounts, Chicago police take action against demonstrators without provocation. The police go on a beating rampage. They beat marchers unconscious, send over 100 to emergency rooms, and arrest 175. When questioned, Mayor Daley says the policeman isn't there to create disorder, the policeman is there to preserve disorder. One of his great quotes. October 2nd, police and military troops in Mexico City react violently to a student-led protest at Tallaco Square. Hundreds of demonstrators are killed or injured. October 3rd, George Wallace, who's been running an independent campaign for the presidency, met with Curtis LeMay to be his running mate. They both announced they would use military or nuclear weapons if necessary. October 12th, the Summer Olympic Games open in Mexico City. The games are boycotted by 32 nations in protest of South Africa's participation. On the 18th, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, U.S. athletes and medalists, disrupt the games by performing a Black Power salute during the Star Spangled Banner. October 31st, President Johnson announces a total halt to U.S. bombings in North Vietnam. Finally, in December, Robert and Ethel Kennedy's daughter is born. On December 21st, the launch of Apollo 8 begins the first mission to orbit the moon. I would guess that many in this room can remember those events because that was a very dramatic year. It was a time where almost every month was September 11th, there was war, there was rioting in the streets, America was coming apart, there were assassinations, political strife, you didn't know who was on what side. It really did feel for all the world like time could not go on much longer. Christians in God's church felt the time of Christ's return must be fairly near. We heard wars, rumors of wars, strife, national chaos. The only element missing was persecution of God's people on a wide scale. Ministers, members, others wondered out loud if perhaps we might be nearing the end, and some figured it could be only a few years away and began to speculate about the time of the church fleeing to a place of safety or the return of Jesus Christ. Looking back now, it's perhaps easy to make fun of or find fault or ridicule with those in the church who, following God sincerely, felt that time was very short back in 1968, or that Christ would return in 72 or 75, or we might have a very short time of it. But there was ample reason, because the year was a terrible year, politically speaking, and it looked for all the world like the United States' power had been completely broken, that the world was coming apart at the seams politically all over, not just in Europe, not just in Poland, with the movements that went on there for independence, the attack on Czechoslovakia, and of course in Mexico City where the games took place and further demonstrations and riots broke out. Things calmed down after that. 1969 wasn't as bad. The riots seemed to subside in the summertime in 1970 and 71. By 1972, Richard Nixon had been reelected. We didn't know, no one knew that he would have to resign a couple years later because of the Watergate scandal. But God did not bring the events of the world to a close at that time, even though for that year, it looked very much like that was possible. Now, there was an earlier time when in God's church, it looked like it was the end of the world. Let's go back to 1 Thessalonians in verse 4. You see, the year 1968 wasn't the only time that from the perspective of a member of God's church, it looked like things are happening very quickly. It looked like perhaps, you know, the riots, the political turmoil, even the persecution on the church, which happened in earlier years, like this may very well be the culmination of some of the prophecies that we know will take place. The abomination of desolation, the great tribulation, famines, pestilences, strife and tumult in many places. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13, Paul writes, I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep or are in the grave in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, so the Lord has promised me this directly, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord. Notice that phrase. You know, we who are alive and remain. Paul felt when he wrote this that Jesus Christ was returning to the earth during his lifetime. Will by no means precede those who are asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then he repeats verse 17, we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds. Now, we can't fault the Apostle Paul for feeling that Christ was coming during his time, because he was watching, not only watching world events, political events, but watching his own life to make sure he was going to be accounted among those who would be qualified to be in God's kingdom. Let's go over to James chapter 5. We find that not only in Paul's writings, but in the writing of James, the writing of John, and of Peter, they all felt Christ was coming in their time. They had this, you know, Christ is coming soon, urgency about them. In James chapter 5 and verse 8, he says, "You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand," or it's near, it's almost here, is what he's saying. James, when he wrote this, said, look, the time of Christ's return is very close. It's at the door. Verse 9, "Don't grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." So James felt that Christ was coming during his time, and he wrote to his people, you know, the time is here, the Lord is at hand. Now, why do you think they wrote that? Why would Paul, James, John write that during their time Christ was coming? Part of the answer may be in the fact that the emperor, the Roman emperor, during the time of most of the New Testament epistles being written, was a man called Nero. And Nero was definitely a crazy individual. Some say perhaps the lead pipes in Rome that had been put in during the time of Cassius, his predecessor, may have caused some of the deranged behavior of the emperors. Nero became emperor in 54 AD. He was 17 years old. He participated in the poisoning of his predecessor, Cassius, whom he replaced, or Claudius. His mother had his half-brother killed so that Nero could be the one made the emperor of Rome. For all of the great accomplishments of Augustus Caesar, perhaps one of the greatest men, talent-wise and vision-wise, to ever rule a great empire, for all of the great accomplishments of Augustus, he never set in place a way to succeed one emperor to the next. There was nothing written down, there were no guidelines. It was basically a feeding frenzy as to who became the next emperor. Normally they were chosen by one emperor through the method of adoption of their favorite nephew or relative or son or whatever it might be. Let me read to you what the famous historian Suetonius says about Nero. Nero was emperor for 14 years until he was driven out of Rome by rebellions around the world, starting in Spain, Britain, Armenia, other places, and all of these Roman armies marching on Rome to dethrone him. But for 14 years, consider what it must have been like living as a Christian in his world. Suetonius says about Nero, "Petulance, lewdness, luxury, avarice, and cruelty. He practiced at first with reserve and in private, as if prompted to them only by the folly of youth, but even then the world was of the opinion they were the faults of his nature. He used to beat those he met coming home from supper. If they made any resistance, he would wound them, throw them into the common sewer. He broke open and robbed shops, established an auction at home for selling his booty. In the scuffles which took place on these occasions, he often ran the hazard of losing his eyes, even his life. When he first became emperor, he had all of the Roman senators and their wives over to his palace, and after dinner he would rape each one of the wives, just to show the senators that he was the king and they could do nothing about it. In the day he would carry on in the theater. He pretended he was a musician and a theater or some kind of an actor, placing himself in the upper part of the proscenium, where he witnessed the quarrels which arose on account of those performances, but also encouraged them. When they came to blows and stones and pieces of benches began to fly, he threw them plentifully amongst the people, even once broke a praetor's head. Besides the abuse of freeborn lads, the debauches of married women, he committed a rape of Rubia, a Vestal virgin. He was upon the point of marrying Octe, his freedwoman, having suborned some men of consular rank to swear she was of royal descent. He gelded the boy Sporus and endeavored to transform him into a woman. He went so far as to marry him formally." So this idea of men marrying men didn't start in our society or in Britain 2 months ago or in Oregon last year. It may have started with Nero. Sporus carried about with him in a litter for solemn assemblies in Greece. However, he also murdered his wives. He had other men's wives murdered. He used to dress up in the skins of wild beasts and go out into the Colosseum, or actually wasn't built by them, he was out into the amphitheater, and abused people. He began the practice of patricide with the murder of Claudia himself, nor did he make any secret afterwards of what he called mushrooms fit for the gods, which of course were the source of his poison. His brother Britannicus was poisoned. His mother made strict use of that. He attempted by magical rites after he had her murdered to bring her ghost up from below. Besides the murder of his mother, he'd been guilty of the murder of his aunt. Besides Octavia, his other two wives, Poppaea Sabina, whose father had borne the office of Maquisator, when he had been married to the Roman knight, and afterwards Statilla Messalina, the granddaughter of Taurus, who was twice consul. To obtain possession of her, he put to death her husband, Attica Vestinus, who was then consul of Rome. He soon became disgusted with Octavia and ceased from having any relations with her. He made several attempts to strangle her. Afterwards, he divorced her, had her put to death because she couldn't have children. He married Pompeia 12 days after the divorce of Octavia, entertained a great affection for her. Nevertheless, he kicked her to death when she was pregnant with his child. There was no person connected with him who escaped his deadly and unjust cruelty. Under pretense of being engaged in a plot against him, he put to death Antonia, Claudius's daughter, who refused to marry him after the death of Pompeia. Now, this goes on for about 12 pages, describing the butchery, the debauchery, and the incredible cruelty of this man named Emperor Nero. Now, all throughout the provinces of Rome, disgruntled Romans began to plot either his removal, his assassination, or his overthrow. One by one, he found out about them. He had them tortured in public. He had them butchered without distinction. He was the most frivolous of pretenses that he killed people. Finally, a Roman general named Gobla over in Spain had the entire Roman army in Western Europe marching on Rome, and Roman armies from around the world began to march on Rome to finally overthrow this pathetic, brutal dictator. Because in 62, when he burned Rome, blamed it on the Christians. He loved to blame anything he could on religious groups who would not worship him. He mentions here what he did to Christians when he found them. The tyrant scrupled not to charge them with the act of burning Rome. He satiated his fury against them by outrages such as they were covered with the skins of wild beasts, torn by dogs, they were crucified, set on fire, that they might serve as lights for the nighttime in Rome. He offered his gardens for a spectacle and exhibited the games of the circus by his dreadful illuminations. Christians were covered with wax and other combustible materials and set up on a spike to be burned alive at night to give light to Rome. I don't want to read too much more. This is the Sabbath. This is God's services. But keep in mind, if you were a writer like Paul or Peter or John during these years, and you saw the whole world coming apart, persecution against Christians, you saw turmoil on every side in the Roman Empire, an empire that had been at peace since the days of Augustus, you would think Christ is coming soon. What more example could there be of a man of sin than a man like Nero? Well, the answer is, of course, his successors. If you look at Caligula and some of the men who came after him who were as bad or perhaps worse. But during that time of great political upheaval, the return of Jesus Christ was expected because there was so much going on. But after the death of Nero, then Vespasian became the king for a while, and of course things calmed down, and the church had a few years of having a little more time to preach the gospel and spread about as Christ wanted them to. Let's go to 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18. Maybe written much later, about the time of Caligula or one of those who came after him even. So it's not wrong to look at world events, to look at political turmoil and chaos, to live through a year like 1968 and say to yourself, you know what, Jesus Christ might return fairly soon. Look at what's going on in the world. Look at the events in prophecy that may be coming to pass. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18, he says, little children, it's the last hour. So in the late 80s, early 90s, when John wrote, he wrote to the church and said, it is the last hour. He thought it was almost time for Christ's return. As you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. John had identified Antichrists, those who were working against the will of Jesus Christ, teaching falsehood in political places, persecuting those who taught the truth. He identified them as Antichrist. He says, we know now that the last hour is coming. In verse 19, he says, they went out from us. So some who had been attending services apparently were in league with the Romans and were then being used to persecute all the Christians that they knew. Well, Christ had not come in the time of 1 Thessalonians, when Nero was probably in his earlier years. He didn't come in the time of James, probably during the later times of Nero. He didn't come in the time of Caligula or the others, Diocletian, who caused severe persecutions upon God's people. In fact, those years came and went. The church went into basically a hiding mode up in Central Europe, only to come out many years later. There is, though, a lesson for all of us, and that is there is another 1968 coming. We don't know what year it will be. We don't know what year we might wake up every month to another September 11th, another great upheaval or riot going on somewhere, another student sit-in, governments invading one another, political chaos, a lack of leadership in America or other places. Who knows what might happen in 2006 or 2007 or 2008 or 2015? We really don't know. But the Bible assures us that there is a time coming which will bring all of these things to pass, and there will be another 1968, a year that will rock the world. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 5. You know, since we really don't know, we have to be diligent, and we have to do what God says concerning redeeming the time, because each one of us only has a few years of our time here on the earth. We can grow, we can attend services, we can read, we can pray, we can develop our relationship with our Creator. It really doesn't matter if another year of political turmoil or huge turmoil happens on the earth today or tomorrow or next year or 1,000 years from now, really. All we have to do is redeem the time that we are given. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Don't worry, God is just, and he will bring his wrath upon those who are the sons of disobedience. They will not get away with their evil deeds. Therefore, don't be partakers with them. You were once in darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk, live as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. That's what we have to do, regardless of what year it is. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. Expose evil for what it is and flee from it. For it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. But all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light, for whatever makes manifest is light. Therefore, he says, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. He says, now it's time to awake. Realize that our time is short, regardless of when we live. See then that you walk circumspectly. We don't have time to waste disobeying God. Not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. The days in which we live are evil, because Christ is not ruling. Satan's society is here and abounding, and we don't know what may come to pass tomorrow, but our goal, in fact, our responsibility, is to redeem the time, because we don't know what tomorrow holds. In fact, we need to have that same urgency about Christ's return as we find in Paul's letters and in James and in John. One of the potentials on the horizon, I think you are all very aware of, is the latest turmoil over in Iran, where one of the individuals who was part of the kidnapping of the Americans and the takeover of the American embassy in 1979, a man named Ahmadinejad, I believe how you pronounce it, is now the ruling dictator, basically, of that country. He came out a few weeks ago and mentioned that when he gave his speech at the UN, it's interesting that the UN allows these men to give speeches, gives them a platform and a podium. He felt that when he was speaking at the UN, he was covered by an aura of light. One of the men says, when you began with the words, in the name of Allah, I saw light coming and surround you and protecting you to the end. He says, on the last day when I was speaking, one of our group told me when I started to say, Bismillah Muhammad, I saw a green light come from around me and I was placed inside this aura. I felt it myself and the atmosphere suddenly changed. Now, what this man believes is that he has a personal role in ushering the return of the Shiite Muslim Messiah. He sees his main mission, as he recounted in November 16th speech in Tehran, by the way, this comes from WorldNet Daily, is to have a path for the glorious reappearance of the Imam Mahdi, that Allah may hasten his reappearance. According to Shiites, the 12th man Imam disappeared as a child in the year 941. When he returns, they believe he'll reign on earth for 7 years before bringing about a final judgment and the end of the world. All Iran is buzzing about the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, and the role of Iran and Muhammadinejad in playing his anticipated return. There's a Messiah hotline. There are news agencies especially devoted to the latest developments. People are anxious to know when and how he will rise and what they must do to receive his worldwide salvation. Muhammadinejad and the others in Iran are deadly serious about the imminent return of the 12th Imam, who will prompt a global battle between good and evil. In other words, if they start a war, they believe the Imam then will return on their side and win the war. When you have crazy people like this in positions of power, crazy things can happen. We don't know what the world will do with this nuclear threat, because this man is arming himself with nuclear weapons and missiles that can hit Israel and other places. It could be a year like 1968. It possibly will calm down and not be that way. All we know is that we don't really know, but the times that we live in are very dangerous. Let's go over now to 2 Peter chapter 3. Peter also talked about the urgency of the times. He spoke about the need for all of us to be monitoring ourselves. He recalled Christ's words, where Christ said, "Don't let that day catch you with surfeiting and the cares of this world strangling you." Peter knew those words very well. In 2 Peter chapter 3, the last of Peter's writing or words that we have, beginning in verse 7, he says, "The heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." He says the world is waiting for the time of fire that will be a judgment of ungodly men. "But beloved, don't forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day." In this letter, the indication is that Peter began to understand the 7,000-year plan of God and to realize that Christ was not coming in the first century, that there would be a long period of about 2 centuries before the actual return of Christ, and that Christians would have to live their life according to God, and then die and wait in the grave until that time. But he says the Lord is not slack concerning his promise. In other words, even if Christ doesn't come, if there is a 7,000-year plan, Christ is not slack concerning his promise. It doesn't mean he's not going to come. It means he is going to come, but simply a little bit later. "As some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." His will is that people come to repentance. "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons you ought to be in holy conduct and godliness." His emphasis is in the way that we ought to live, with holy conduct and godliness, because we understand that the world and all that it has is someday going to be burned up and blown away in the wind. He says, "Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God." And what that really means is eagerly waiting for. The word hastening doesn't mean we can do something that somehow changes God's calendar or plan. That's a misunderstanding that from time to time has been spoken about. It simply means we need to look for, eagerly awaiting and working towards, or working as hard as we can to be a part of, the coming day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. So it says we simply need to do all that we can to be eagerly awaiting Christ's return, to be working towards that in our own personal life, learning how to obey God, keep his days, keep his laws, have the fruits of God's Spirit, and be ready to be used by God for whatever purpose he has for us in the future. Then in verse 13, "Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein righteousness dwells." That's what we look forward to. It doesn't matter what year it happens. There will be years of turmoil in the future. there will be times of great political turmoil. There will be wars and rumors of wars and diseases. There will be earthquakes and famines. There will be governmental control over your life such as we've never had before in our experience. Nevertheless, we look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. We need to have a sense of urgency. We need to realize that what many of us who are old enough to recall 1968 went through is going to happen again, only in a much more intense, a much more earth-shaking fashion. And that there will be the real years when those things will lead up to the return of Christ. God has given us a few years here in the meantime to do what he says here, to look forward to a new heaven, a new earth, where righteousness really will dwell. Our job is to be looking towards those things, to be diligent, to be found by him, to be living a life of peace, without spot and blameless, and doing the work that he gave us to do. What I hope is that in a few years, or whenever these things come to pass, some of you of the younger set, who have looked at some of us older, balder, grayer, aged people, and said, remember back when you thought Christ was coming in 1975? That you will someday say, now I understand.